right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, and it's going to be a hell of a show because we're living in a hell of a time. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with John Polano, the author of the play Rules of Seconds. And, well, we'll talk about that when we get there. All right? I saw the play recently. It's a very good play and raises a lot of important questions that need to be raised today. Before that, we'll be listening to a conversation I had with Michael Mann, director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University and the author of many books and dozens of articles and the lead author of the article that introduced the iconic hockey stick graph showing a dramatic increase in global temperatures. And we'll be talking with him about what the hell is facing humanity now in terms of the climate and what's being done about it. And opening the show up, I'm extremely pleased to welcome back to the show Sansara Taylor. We're opening the show up this show with the discussion of the emergency situation today. And there's been a call put out for Basta Ya, Enough, 10 days of resistance beginning with the March for Science, April 22nd. Over the course of 10 days, hundreds of thousands of people will pour into the streets in important and righteous protests in Washington, D.C. and cities across the country. And this is a crucial moment to organize many thousands of people under the banner of No, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept fascist America. Drive out the Trump-Pence regime. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, well, let's jump into this because I don't want to lose a minute. All right, let's talk about this. There's been this call, as I just said, for these 10 days of being in the streets, being out there, 10 days of resistance. What are you talking about? Why it's necessary? What's happening here?
Okay, well, first, I want to say we definitely have to talk about the 10 days, and it's actually underscored by what's happened in the last 24 hours, and I have to start there because last night Trump unleashed 59 Tomahawk missiles, cruise missiles, on Syria. This is the first new major escalation of military violence enforced by this new fascist regime. It is a very, very dangerous thing. It's bad for the people of Syria, it's bad for the people of the region, it's bad for the people of the world, and it's our responsibility to stand up and say no U.S. bombs on Syria. The U.S. has no right to be bombing any country. Donald Trump came out and said, oh, I was moved by the pictures of this beautiful Syrian babies who were killed in a gas attack, allegedly by the Assad regime. And that attack, that chemical attack, is a crime against humanity. It is outrageous, but Donald Trump does not care about the Syrian children, and he's not bombing in the interest of the Syrian children. He doesn't care about the Yemeni children who he's backing sanctions that are starving, hundreds of thousands of them, starving them and thousands of them to death. He doesn't care about the beautiful Iraqi children who have been blown to bits by U.S. bombs over decades. He doesn't care about the children who were killed under U.S. drones in Yemen not long ago or in Mosul. He doesn't care about the beautiful children of the planet who are being endangered by his climate denying. And I just think, one, I want to start with this because this is a major crime that's being carried out right now as we speak. And whether people are passive or whether people go into the streets right now today, there are emergency protests called all over the country, makes a big difference. And I call on people to go to refusefascism.org and get the list of protests, the protests in your area, wherever you are, and then to take this up as part of driving out this fascist regime, which does link to the 10 days of resistance we should talk about. But we just have to start today. The bombs are falling in our names, and we have to stand up and stop it. And today, Gorsuch just got confirmed to the Supreme Court. They changed this is part of the fascist takeover of the country, the remaking of the courts, the remaking of the Senate rules, and confirming him in the face of a completely illegitimate nominee. This is a very dangerous situation that we're facing. So I just wanted to start there.
No, I'm glad you did. That's actually where I was going to go anyway. So it's okay. I intended to actually put it there, but I know that there's been a lot of plans for demonstrations. People have started getting out the news around that, and people, from the moment they heard about this, and it was a shock to a lot of people. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm wondering at the same time that this whole thing, it really raises to people, I think. It raises to people what exactly is going on. When we talk about this as a fascist regime, what does it mean that this is a fascist regime? People will look at it and say, well, it doesn't seem like Hitler. It doesn't seem like Pinochet. It doesn't seem like we still have some freedom. We have abilities to do this. And, you know, there's really an inability or a denial in practice here of, like, what actually is going on. And it's very concerning.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important to understand, and this is something that refusefascism.org speaks to in its main call to action, its mission statement, is fascism is more than a collection of very reactionary policies. And Trump has a collection of ghouls, of neo-Nazis, of white supremacists, you know, in his cabinet, and war criminals, and he has a collection of extremely harmful reactionary policies. And it's important that every single one of them be called out and resisted. His climate denying, his calls for law and order, which is not very code word for even more brutal and racist terror and murder unleashed on black and brown people by police, his grotesque bragging about sexual assaults on women and his, you know, in the first days of his regime, enacting the global gag order, which is denying women the right and access to abortion all over the world, and it's going to cost, it's a death sentence for millions of women. His anti-immigrant, his Muslim ban, his xenophobic, his wall building, his deportations, his whipping up of the lynch mob hate crime wave across this country. There's all kinds of, you know, any one of these is an outrage. Every one of these is an outrage and must be opposed. But when we call him a fascist, and when we say he's got a fascist regime, we're talking about all of that together with the fact that he is remaking the form of government in this country. He is remaking. Now, it's been a capitalist dictatorship since its founding, okay? Well, it was founded with a capitalist dictatorship together with a slave system. So it was a coalition system of two forms of exploitation. But now it's a capitalist imperialist dictatorship, and it's been that way. Which is why, you know, I say America's never been great. You say America's never been great. This is something why we're fighting for a revolution. But at the same time, with Trump, it's not just more of the same. He's changing the form of rule towards a fascist form of rule where he's stripping even the pretense of democratic rights, even the limited protections that people had with the separation of powers and the separation of church and state, and the right to a trial, and the right to, you know, at least if you waged a huge political battle, you could say you have to provide evidence before you send somebody to prison. Now, obviously, they send a lot of people to prison anyhow, but at least you had the courts as a form. If you waged a massive struggle, you could get redress. These are things that Trump is dispatching with. He's destructing. Fascism is an openly terroristic form of bourgeois dictatorship. It is strongman rule. It is rule through lynch mob terror among your base, among the violent Trump supporters, but also even more dangerously, the restructuring of the state to not allow people to stand up and oppose it, and to not even allow people within the halls of power to oppose them. And that's a lot of what Trump has done, firing the acting attorney general, disparaging and threatening judges, threatening to lock up and even assassinate his opponent in the election. This is a qualitative leap and even more dangerous. And the point is, fascism advances in stages. It doesn't come out one day and say, hey, we're going to take away all the rights and build concentration camps. And he's basically said that's a lot of what he wants to do. But it advances in stages, shock, awe, and then periods of normalization. But it stays on the march. And this is what we're living through. They're in power. The fascists are in power. And they are remaking the courts. They are assaulting the separation of powers. They are unleashing terror on Syria and threatening it to the rest of the world. They are doing these things. They're also doing it in stages, and it's being normalized. And people are being told, last night, it was one of the most disgusting things. You flipped every channel on the news, not just Fox cheering for these missiles, but MSNBC, the so-called liberals. You know, they're out there cheering for this, too, and it's being normalized. They're saying, oh, he's finally acting presidential. No, he's acting like a criminal, and he should be opposed. It should not be normalized. And so we're in a period where the fascism is not consolidated. We still have the ability to get out there and protest and resist, but that's going to be closed. That window will be closed if we do not get out there, protest, resist, and then drive them from power.
I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and an initiator of Refuse Fascism. And we're talking about Basta Ya, Enough, 10 Days of Resistance. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. Drive out the Trump-Pence regime. Now, this interview was recorded immediately following the massive U.S. missile attack on Syria. Let me ask you this, Sansara, for just a minute here. You know, because as you're talking, I keep thinking, okay, you know, look, this is a very serious crisis for all of humanity. And I keep thinking about people don't understand this crisis. And there's a lot of, you know, I've heard people on the radio this morning as I was coming over here, people talking about, well, you know, we have to look at the balance of power. We have to look at how are we going to actually approach this. It's all this kind of stuff that's talking about things like they are what they always were, that there's this sort of the normal workings with the jerk in power, but that this is the kind of thing that you can actually deal with. And it's very heavy for me to, you know, when you're listening to this, because there is this situation of, look, fascism requires actually a certain recognition and not, you know, I heard people like, for instance, this morning talking about, well, you know, we do have checks and balances here. You know, other people talking about the deep state. And when I kept thinking about that and how the deep state was actually something that steps in and solves problems when there's things are going awry. And I kept thinking about all these explanations of how the system is actually able to take care of itself, to work things out. Meanwhile, fascism is being hammered down before our very eyes.
Well, I think that what you're raising is really important. And it's really important that people, you know, two things I want to say. That one, we are writing every day at revcom.us. And this is a website people need to go to every day to understand beneath the surface what is really going on. I'm going to say a little bit about it, but I think people should be going to this website. I really recommend it. Right now, there's a lot of fighting going on among the rulers because Trump and Pence and this regime is a very radical restructuring of U.S. imperialism. It's a fascist restructuring of this country and of this country's relationship to the world, and it's a major change, and it should not be underestimated. In that context, because they actually are in a situation of extreme crisis. They're facing big challenges in the world that are driving them to this extreme. They're facing big challenges within this country. There's a lot of fighting among the rulers over what's the best way to go forward, and they're struggling over it. But Obama said something important when Trump got elected. He said, this is an intramural skirmish between the Democrats and the Republicans and the different factions of the rulers. We're all on the same team. And this is very important. They are on the same team. They're fighting. And there are sections, there's no deep state, but there are sections of the CIA, there are sections of the military, there are sections of the Democrats, there's even sections of the Republicans who have big differences with how to shore up U.S. imperialist rule and domination in the world. They are struggling over it, but it's an intramural struggle. They're on the same team. This team is opposed. Their team as a whole, even with all their factions and fractious fighting, are opposed to the interests of humanity. They are not our team. They are the team that will work together and cheer for cruise missiles in Syria, which could escalate into a much bigger conflagration. People should understand this is very dangerous. It's a very volatile world. Their team is united behind mass incarceration and the slow genocide, which could become a fast genocide and is speeding up against black and brown people. Their team is united on massive deportations that have ripped families apart and now is going to a whole new level under Trump. Their team is opposed to the fundamental rights of women to control their own reproduction. Abortion has been being hammered at, whittled away. Their team is for mass dragnet spying and repression. So they'll fight with each other over how far to go at what time. But right now, Trump and Pence's fascist regime has the reins of power and they have initiative. And it's very dangerous and they're moving forward. And here's the most important thing. Nobody, and then I'll get to the 10 days because I know we're running out of time. The most important thing is that the Democrats and every other section of the rulers from the CIA who are bad people, torturers, worldwide torturers, FBI, all these sections of the state, they have more interest in maintaining the rule and stability of U.S. imperialism than they do even with real differences sometimes with Trump. They have more interest in the stability of the system than they do in stopping fascism. And so they will continue to go along. They might fight a little bit, but they'll go along. And that's what we've seen with the normalization, the accommodation, and the going along with Trump approving his cabinet of fascists, approving, saying, we'll work with him. Now, the only thing that we have, the masses of people who do not want to live in a fascist America that is bombing and terrorizing the world, we have to rely on ourselves. And I will say this, we have to resist. People say protest doesn't matter. They're wrong. People say, oh, you've got to work within the channels, the elections. That's not true. Only real fundamental change has come when people go outside of the normal political channels. That's what they did when they burned their draft cards. and refused to fight in Vietnam. That's what the Freedom Rides were that won civil rights. That's what the 60s were. That's what everything that has made an advance for humanity, for the oppressed, has been through people going into the streets, putting their bodies on the line, and doing it in massive numbers, and stopping, looking up for a savior in the Democratic Party or in the political establishment, and looking out, there are millions and millions of us who are sick at heart, who are disgusted, who are terrorized, who are outraged. We have to find our strength, and we have to look out at each other, and we have to organize ourselves and go into the streets and not do it to plead with them and hope they'll listen, but do it in a way that refuses to stop, that is demanding that they be driven from power and refusing to stop, so that they have to calculate our demand. Not they have to know we feel it, but they have to realize their same calculus as rulers, that we want the stability of the empire, has to say, wow, we're not going to have stability unless we make a change, because these people are so determined they're not stopping. RefuseFascism.org is calling for millions and millions to go in the streets and stay in the streets night after night, day after day, to drive this regime from power, refusing to stop until they're driven out. And we see the 10 days coming up at the end of the month as very key in getting us closer to the time when millions are ready to do that. On April 22nd, there's a very important march for science. Science is under assault. Climate change is being denied. The government agencies that provide funds for sciences and that do research are being gutted. They're being muzzled. They're being threatened. They're being purged. It's very important that people stand up and join the marches for science all over the country on April 22nd. On April 29th, there's a People's March for Climate. This is essential. The whole world is imperiled by the dangerous things. I know you're going to have the interview later, so I'll be brief. But this is the future of our planet, the oceans, the air, the land. It's an emergency. We should all be in the streets. And then May 1st, for immigrant rights all over this country, and this is something immigrants and Muslims need to overcome their fear and be out in the streets, but everybody who was born here, everybody who is non-Muslim, everybody who is a U.S. citizen, everybody who is not directly affected, you have extra responsibility to be out in the streets on May 1st and say, no, we will not sit back. And so each of these needs to be massively powerful in their own right, and RefuseFascism.org is calling for people to flood the streets for all three of these. We're also, this is my last point, we are calling for people to join the major Refuse Fascism contingents in each of these marches. To march, we want thousands and thousands of people marching and joining with these protests, but doing it under the banner of, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Drive out the Trump-Pence regime. Drive them from power. This needs to be a big thing that gets organized and put in society in a much bigger way. And these 10 days at the end of April can make a big difference in changing the mood, changing the feel, and breaking out the kind of massive sustained resistance that is really going to be required to prevent a catastrophe for humanity, which is the Trump-Pence regime consolidating their fascist rule. And so I know we're over time, so I'm just going to squeeze one last thing in, which is you should go to refusefascism.org. You can sign up today concretely. Fill out the form and tell us which marches you can be at and that you'll join the contingent. Find the meeting where you are for Refuse Fascism. And if there's not one in your area, then set one up. There's instructions how to do it. There's tools and resources. And go on Twitter and follow at Refuse Fascism. Go to Facebook.com/Refuse Fascism and become a friend of Refuse Fascism on Facebook. And write in at info@refusefascism.com to get on the email list. We have to get connected. We have to get organized. Mm-hmm. So I thank you for letting me squeeze all that
yeah,
in.
Yeah, no, that's great, man. That's really great. Sisters and brothers, this is a crisis for humanity, and it's something people really have to face up to and stand up against and do what is actually required of you in the name of humanity. That's what you have to think about. This is a very serious situation. Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Talk to you again soon. Bye. All right, that was Sansara Taylor, and we've just been talking about In the Name of Humanity, Bastiat Enough, 10 Days of Resistance, In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America and Drive Out the Trump-Pence Regime, what's behind it and what's necessary for people to do. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
imagine holding planet Earth in the palm of your hand, with no regard for your place of birth or claim to any land. The only thing between us now is the truth we understand. If planet Earth was in the palm of your hand, will they say about us here? Did we care for the water and the fragile atmosphere?
Welcome back. That was Prince with Planet Earth. Dr. Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University, and he's got a joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. He's also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, and he's the author of several books, including his most recent work, The Madhouse Effect, which features cartoons by Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Tom Tolles. And he's joining us now to talk about what the hell is going on in the era of Trump and the environment. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's really good to have you back, man. I'm really looking forward to this. So let's jump into it. Basically, the situation facing the planet and all of humanity in relation to the climate is dire, and that's putting it just very simply, and it's growing worse by the day. Give people a capsulized understanding of where things are at now.
We are literally just seeing the tip of the veritable iceberg when it comes to the impacts of climate change, because there is probably another half a degree Celsius, nearly a whole degree Fahrenheit warming that's still in the pipeline. That is to say, even if we stop burning carbon right now, we would see that additional amount of warming. And already, just from the warming that has occurred, the impacts of climate change, as I like to say, are no longer subtle. We see them play out now literally in the 24-hour news cycle, on our television screens, in our newspapers. The extreme weather events, many of the extreme weather events we've seen here in the U.S. over the last year or two, unprecedented floods, droughts, and the list goes on. We can see the fingerprint of human activity now in those events.
Well, look, tell me this then. In relation to everything you've just said, you know, you can see how important this is in terms of what's going on in the world today and into the future. And climate science, in spite of that, has to be one of the most attacked sciences in history. Scientists are also directly under attack if they object to what's going on in terms of the climate and what to do about it. I mean, you're kind of stuck, you know? It's sort of, if you open your mouth and you know, say what you know, right, and point out to people what's going on, you come under attack. And the science itself is really under brutal attack now.
Yeah, well, it's rather ironic, right? You don't see concerted attacks by industry front groups when it comes to cosmology, black holes, the theory of gravity, organic chemistry. There are no lobbies that exist to discredit scientists in those fields. But when it comes to climate change, the science, the findings of the scientific community have proven inconvenient to some powerful vested interests, to fossil fuel interests who don't like the implications of what we're finding, namely that we have to get off our addiction to fossil fuels and transition to renewable energy and non-carbon energy. That, of course, is a threat to their bottom line. They are profiting greatly from our current addiction to fossil fuels, and they have used that immense power and wealth to wage what is arguably the greatest disinformation campaign in the history of human civilization, the campaign to deny and attack the science of climate change.
Now, you know, the thing is that you were just also recently part of this whole panel that was set up in Congress around discussing this. And it was really, yeah, you know, you had the three chuckleheads that were in there, and then they had you. They were sort of presenting it as, well, this is a panel of experts, you know,
right,
and then, you know, you had to sit over there and look at these guys. It was like looking at the Three Stooges, you know.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, you know, and there was a great John Oliver segment that I think really cut to the chase. In the way that this sort of false portrayal of debate, the way that this congressional committee, in this case the chair of the House Science Committee, Lamar Smith, is a climate change denier whose largest source of funding is the fossil fuel interest, and he invited three contrarians and one mainstream scientist, that was me, when in fact, if you look at the actual scientific literature, when you look at publishing scientists, 97% or more of scientists in this field actually agree with the consensus that I described at that hearing, and a tiny minority you know, have the sorts of views that were represented by the three contrarian witnesses. And so, whereas in reality it's 97% in that House hearing, the overwhelming consensus of the world scientists was represented by 25% of the witnesses. And, you know, that is the sort of distortion that is intended to make the public and policymakers think that there is a debate about the science of climate change when there is none in the legitimate scientific discourse. That having been said, you know, I had one very powerful weapon, the truth. Mm-hmm. And by all accounts, the Republican majority and their witnesses fared very poorly because they don't have the truth on their side. They weren't prepared. They didn't make cogent arguments because there aren't cogent arguments to be made against the reality of human-caused climate change. So I think in the end, you know, truth and facts prevailed, despite the fact that the hearing was really intended to sow doubt about the science, to justify an agenda of inaction by congressional Republicans and our Republican president.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that it brought up to me again, too, though, was something that you wrote about a while back, which was called the Serengeti Strategy. And I'd like you to talk about that because it seemed to be very evident in what they were trying to push up there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, I recount an experience back a couple decades ago when I was at a scientific conference in Kenya and Tanzania. And I had a chance to go out to see the Serengeti and the amazing creatures that roam the Serengeti. And one of the striking scenes that I saw were zebras standing back to back to form a wall of stripes. That's how they avoid being targeted by predators, by lions, by sort of blending into the background. And if one of them gets isolated, they become vulnerable. So I used that analogy to describe the way that climate change deniers, congressional climate change deniers, you know, holding show trials to attack climate scientists like myself, or the various op-eds in conservative-leaning newspapers that target individual climate scientists like myself for ridicule and condemnation. That is intended to isolate. They know that they are up against a wall of facts, a wall of consensus. And so all they can hope to do is try to pick off one of those zebras and make an example of them, right? Attack one scientist and try to send a message to all the other scientists that if you two speak out about the reality and threat of climate change, we're going to come after you too. So I think it's very clear that that is the message that they're trying to send to the scientific community. I, for one, will have no part of it, and that's why I was there to defend the mainstream science of climate change and to make sure that misinformation and disinformation did not rule the day.
And you did a very good job of it as well, which is very, very
Thank
good.
You.
Yeah. One of the critical arguments, though, is the scientists' insistence, your insistence and scientists' insistence on examining both natural and human causes. And that seems to drive them up a wall. I wanted you to talk about this because particularly in relation to, while they try to present everything as well, it's all natural causes and it's happening and there's ebb and flow and it comes up and it hits us sometimes and it goes back. But you've actually argued that there's natural and human causes. And human causes are actually playing a huge role in what's happening in the world today.
Yeah, that's right. It's a sort of a false dichotomy, this picture that they depict where it's all or nothing. Either it's all natural variability or it's no natural variability, or more to the point that it's all natural variability and very little human impact, which is, of course, not what the facts indicate. So there's this effort to magnify, to exaggerate the role of natural climate variability, to make it sound like, hey, you know, there's natural variability. There's no way we can tell if we're really changing the planet. Climate change is naturally anyways, so why should we care about this? And it's so wrong-headed. It's wrong on the facts, and it's an extremely misleading argument anyways. First of all, the warming that we've seen, we know is caused by the burning of fossil fuels and the increase in carbon in our atmosphere. In fact, natural factors, our best efforts to estimate the impact of natural factors, volcanoes, small but measurable changes in the brightness of the sun, those natural factors have actually acted slightly to cool the climate a little bit over the last half century. And human-caused greenhouse warming has completely overwhelmed that small natural cooling trend and, in fact, given us a very substantial warming trend. And so we are literally most likely responsible for more than 100% of the warming that we have seen, because we actually overcame a small natural trend that was in the opposite direction. That's a temporary trend. It eventually would turn around, but over the last half century, it's actually been in the opposite direction, and we've warmed as much as we have in spite of that. Finally, so natural causes can't explain the warming. In fact, they go in the wrong direction. And when you point to uncertainty, because that was the other topic that they tried to sort of insert into the discussion to emphasize the existence of uncertainty. Well, uncertainty cuts both ways. Despite what Lamar Smith and his witnesses tried to tell observers, uncertainty actually is a reason for taking even greater action, because it can cut both ways. And in many respects, as we start to resolve some of the uncertainty, we're finding that things are actually, in many respects, worse than we originally thought. We're losing sea ice in the Arctic faster than we thought we would. We are seeing the disappearance of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet, the loss of ice from these two major ice sheets, well ahead of where the models said we should be. And so they're already contributing to sea level rise ahead of schedule. So uncertainty is actually cutting against us in many respects. The uncertainty is sort of, as we resolve it, we're again learning that things are happening even faster than we had originally predicted. And so it's a reason to act even sooner. It's a reason for more concerted action, just the opposite of what the critics would like you to think uncertainty means here.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State, and with joint appointments at the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. He's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, and he's the author of several books, including his most recent work, The Madhouse Effect, which features cartoons by Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Tom Tolles. As you were talking, I was thinking about that in relation to the what you were just talking about a little bit a minute ago about the hockey stick graph, because that's actually, the thing is when you look at that now, and somebody was saying to me, God, if you look at that now, it's probably so much bigger than that antiquated picture you have in your book. You know?
And well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, the so-called blade of the hockey stick, which is the modern warming, with each year, that blade gets longer, and we enter into even more unprecedented territory. We just saw the third consecutive warmest year on record. And so to those who say, oh, global warming, it slowed down, it stopped, of course, that's nonsense. We've seen for the first time on record three consecutive record-breaking warm years. And along with that, the unprecedented rash of extreme weather events, floods, droughts, heat waves, we are seeing the impacts of that warming in the extreme weather that we are increasingly dealing with here in the U.S. and around the world, and that creates all sorts of problems, not the least of which is conflict, and the sort of conflict that drives societal instability, like the Syrian uprising ultimately precipitated terrorist groups like ISIS, that had at its root an unprecedented drought in Syria that forced rural farmers into the cities where there was more competition for resources that led to conflict and instability that we are now dealing with in the form of international terrorism.
Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about the ice melting. You know, I just recently had on the show Josh Willis, who's works with the
Okay.
You know, he is. He's very good. And he's been doing a lot of coverage of, it's his OMG, right? His OMG project.
Yeah.
And basically, he's been talking a lot about the melting of ice, of Arctic ice. He's been melting of ice in the oceans, and even more, the melting of actual huge ice sheets. Let's talk about that, because that's something you've delved into, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the melting of the sea ice is one thing, because sea ice can sort of come and go. It tends to form a lot of it in the winter, and then it melts back in the summer. And there's always, at least in the past, there's always been some sea ice that persists through the summer, and that's critical because unique creatures like the polar bear rely on that environment, and we see that environment now disappearing. But here's the good news. If we turn the thermostat back down, the Arctic sea ice comes back. So that is not, it's not what we call a tipping point. We don't think we're going to go past the point of no return. If we can bring our carbon emissions under control and ultimately cool the planet back down, then we can bring back the Arctic sea ice. Now, here's the thing. Arctic sea ice, when that melts, that's ice that's floating on the ocean to start with, and so when it melts, it doesn't raise global sea level. But when you melt continental ice sheets, that's ice that's stored on land, that will increase global sea level. And here's the other problem. When you start to melt the great ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet, the West Antarctic ice sheet, the large chunk of the Antarctic ice sheet that's most susceptible to melting, once you set that in motion, it is very difficult to stop it. There is a tipping point, and we may have crossed a tipping point now where we've warmed up the climate enough that we've set in motion the destabilization of most, if not all, of the West Antarctic ice sheet, enough ice to eventually give us 10 to 14 feet of sea level rise. That may be baked in. We don't know how long it will take for that to play out, but we may have ensured that that will happen no matter what. Even if we try to turn the thermostat back down, those processes take on a sort of a life of their own, and once they get going, it's almost impossible to reverse them. So that's the real worry, in fact, is the fact that we're seeing the loss of ice in the major ice sheets decades ahead of schedule, sooner than the climate models said we should see it. That is a cause for great concern.
And just to make the point again, the cause of all this is actually has a lot to do with human-caused changes and not so much periodic natural events. Because you hear people talk about, here in California, you hear people talking about, well, yeah, it's raining like hell. It's like more than we've ever seen. But, you know, just a couple years ago, we had a drought, you know, just last summer. It was like everything was dry. Your trees were falling over, cracking because they had no water. Just it's a cyclical thing. It'll go by. But you're actually arguing, and I think this is extremely important for people to talk about, you're actually arguing that these human-caused changes and not periodic events are out there, that these things that they're talking about are actually human-caused changes that are fundamentally changing the climate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what we see in California is a perfect example because we just came out of an unprecedented drought, the worst drought on record. And when I say on record, the paleoclimate folks tell us it's the worst drought in more than 1,000 years in California. And what we expect to be true, as a result of global warming, it dries out the soil in the summer, it leads to less snowpack in the winter in general, so you have less runoff in the spring. Climate change will worsen drought in regions like California, but there will be intermittent years, like El Nino years, will still happen. And when they do happen, and there is rainfall and precipitation, you get a lot more of it. So literally, you see more extremes in both directions, more persistent droughts of greater magnitude and greater duration, but punctuated by intermittent seasons of extremely heavy rainfall and snowfall, and we've seen the damaging effects that that has had in California this year with the, you know, the collapse of the dam and the flooding that they've been dealing with. So you're dealing with worse extremes at both ends, and both of those extremes are costly, and it's that variability that is very difficult to manage when you're alternating between flooding and drought. It's very difficult to design resilient systems for meeting our water needs and for agriculture and for maintaining the health of ecosystems when you have more of these extremes. We published an article just a week ago in the journal Scientific Reports, one of the Nature journals, that demonstrates a new mechanism that we're just starting to really understand for how climate change is actually creating more persistent wiggles in the jet stream that give us these very unusual and persistent anomalous weather patterns, droughts, heat waves, floods. So in addition to the basic physics that is making these events more common, we also think that climate change is literally changing the jet stream in a way that produces more of these stuck patterns of the jet stream where you get the day after day of rainfall or day after day of baking sun. That's when you get extreme, persistent weather anomalies.
Mm-hmm. Now, entering into it all, Trump. Trump's plan, you called it a middle finger to science. Let's talk about that.
I don't remember doing that, but I would agree with it. So if I did say it, I stand by it. Yeah, I mean, Trump has literally turned his back on science in this country. He's defunding science in general, but especially science that's inconvenient to the funders and the special interests that rule his campaign. I mean, his you know, most of his cabinet members, the people he's appointed to key positions, have ties to the fossil fuel industry or the Koch brothers, the largest privately owned fossil fuel interest. So it's literally the fox not just guarding the hen house, but running the hen house at this point when it comes to issues like climate change. And it's sort of a worst-case scenario from a domestic politics standpoint to have such a an anti-science president, Donald Trump, who's trying to undo all of the achievements of the previous administration when it comes to dealing with climate change and when it comes to studying the problem of climate change, working together with congressional Republicans who have very much the same agenda, the Koch brothers-driven agenda of gutting environmental protections and basically de-incentivizing the move towards renewable energy and doubling down in subsidies for fossil fuel, for the continued mining of fossil fuels and the continued destruction of our environment. It's sort of a worst-case scenario. Fortunately, we're just one country. The rest of the world is moving on, moving away from fossil fuel energy towards renewable energy. It's clear that that is the direction the world is moving. And at this point, it's simply a matter of whether we get on board or we get left behind.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question, the idea of the March for Science. And that, to me, is extremely important. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to participating in that. I will be speaking at the rally. I'll be marching, hopefully, with my good friend Bill Nye, the science guy. And, you know, the event has been endorsed by major science organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Science. There's a lot of mainstream support for one simple reason. Science is under attack like never before under the current administration and with the enablers within the congressional Republican establishment. Scientists prefer, I can tell you, a lot of my friends, fellow scientists, prefer to be left alone in their labs, working on science, figuring things out, doing experiments, discovering. That's what scientists love doing. And it's only when matters truly get out of hand where scientists tend to become political. And so when you see scientists marching in the streets, which is what we will see in Washington, D.C. later this month, you know things are pretty bad. And it's an expression from the scientific community that we're not going to take it anymore. And I think it's very important. I think that message has to be heard, and I think scientists need to lend their voice to that message, and that's what we'll see. That's what we'll see come April 22nd.
Yeah, definitely. I have one more question for you, and it's something that I just want you to just riff on a little bit when I read it. And it's from a scientist named Ardea Skybrake, and it's in her book, Science of Evolution and the Myth of Creationism. I was very moved by this, and I wanted to hear your thoughts after hearing this. It says, when people are deprived of a scientific approach to reality as a whole, they are robbed of both a full appreciation of the beauty and richness of the natural world and the means to understand the dynamics of change, not only in nature, but in human society as well.
Amen. I think that's a wonderful statement, and I think it underscores something. That science is not just about solving specific problems, working out the solutions to mathematical equations, or mixing things together in test tubes. It's really about how you look at the world. It's about taking a fact-driven approach to how you look at the world. And so while it has implications, obviously, for how we do science, it has implications for how we view our place on this planet and in this universe. And I think that's part of why you see scientists now getting political, because they understand that that place is now threatened.
All right, Michael Mann, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, and definitely looking to having you back on the show real soon, man.
Let's do it.
Okay, Sounds good. Take care now. Bye now.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
All right, we've just been talking with Dr. Michael Mann, who's the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. He's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Dr. Mann is the author of more than 200 peer-reviewed and edited publications and has published 3 books. And his most recent one is The Madhouse Effect, co-authored with Washington Post editorial cartoonist Tom Tolles. He's also the co-founder of the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And I really suggest if you want to find out anything about science, go to that website, realclimate.org. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
know of your crimes. But you don't want to fix this world.
Welcome back. Yeah, I almost couldn't stop that music, okay, because I just love this. Right? It's Honky Tonk Rules from P.E., Public Enemy. All right. Now, just a couple weeks ago, I saw a play, and I have to tell you, I missed the opening night through my own fault, and went the next day, and I was sitting there, and I was just mesmerized by what I saw. We're going to be talking with the author of the play, and the play is Rules of Seconds, and the author's name is John Polono. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, man? Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm doing good, man. Why don't you tell people what the play is about?
Sure. So it's a theatrical experience, like what I like to call it. It's a play, it takes place in 1855 in Boston, and it's a sort of deep dive on the Code Duello, which is the series of rules that were created to govern people who get into duels. And it's really about toxic masculinity and sort of the shackles of manhood from back then. And it's this sort of a huge ensemble. There's 10 actors and about 15 different characters, and it's at its core, it's about a guy who gets challenged to a duel who doesn't fit the definition of what a man is of the time, and he has to enlist his estranged brother to be his second, and then they sort of try to navigate it, and then to bloody conclusions. So in a nutshell, that's what it is. But it's a very dark comedy with some, you know, thriller tense moments and some drama there. It's a bunch of stuff.
And there's a way that you present this that actually makes it so universal. It's really a trip because you're looking at it, and yeah, it's like in what, 1855 or something?
Right.
And, you know, you're looking at this, and at the same time, the very same things that are being fought out today in a lot of ways are actually being fought out on the stage in front of you, from the relationship between white people and black people, from immigrants and the system, and from men and women, and particularly men and women. And the one character that really stands out, played by Amy Bremerman, right? Played by her, where it's actually, you're looking at this, and for the longest time, she's sort of in there in the center of it, but you don't really, even the way you've written it, and the way it's staged, your attention is drawn more to the male players, and she's sort of there and occupying a central spot. But it's sort of creeping up on you about the importance of the role that she's playing in the play, which I thought was just brilliant the way you did that, man.
Well, absolutely, man. I appreciate that. And, you know, definitely that's what we were going for. You know, and the director, Joe Bonney, who I've worked with a bunch of times, is just, like, brilliant, and she is just, she brings such an amazing energy and thought to it. Like, nothing happens on that stage that she didn't sort of intend to happen, which is just such a great collaboration. She takes everything and just amplifies it. And especially with Amy's character, very much what you said, you know, she's sort of at the whim of all these guys. And then at the end, she finally has enough and she sort of makes the most sort of climactic decision of the whole play. And yeah, that's by design. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the play is a lot more resonant than we thought it would be. I mean, a lot of the themes in it we thought would be universal and stuff that's certainly relevant to this time. But it's interesting having a play that's so reflective of the current moment in time we have. And like I said, it's really fascinating to be part of. But at the same time, I would trade all of that to have less volatile times, for sure.
Well, you know, it is interesting because I'm just looking at something that was done, and I can't remember where I saw this, but they were talking about exactly that point, and they were talking about Joe Bonney making this point that it's a period piece, but John's take on it is very 2017, quick, smart, funny, and socially responsible. And I do think it's interesting when she talks about the mix of characters coming from all strata society and the privileged elite, the working class, and immigrants from many cultures. I mean, I was just stunned by how much you managed to fit onto that stage. And everyone had some way where, to a certain level, there was a certain amount of dignity that there was all kinds of contradictions that were being wrestled out. And there was a certain dignity to the people that sort of occupy the bottom levels of society. But there was also, even there was all kinds of just crap that they were doing to each other and in relation to women in particular. There was all this stuff that came to a head in every level. And I thought it was, one, it was amazing that you were able to write this with all of these things going on at once. But staging it was a whole other thing, man, in terms of really keeping all these characters in place and moving in this direction.
Well, I mean, look, I attribute that to Joe Bonney and to this, you know, remarkable cast. I mean, sort of the interesting thing to
to step back, I mean, this is always, this story in particular, I've written a lot of plays and I make my living as a writer in other ways, but I've stuck with it for so long, it's gone through so many iterations, but I'm part of a group called the Temblers, and we're this Los Angeles playwright collective, and this is our first production, and there's seven of us. It's a very diverse group. I'm Italian, but I'm like a white guy from all intents and purposes, and collaborating with such a diverse group has really, really helped, and it informed the last sort of evolution of the play, which originally it was a primarily white cast, and it diversified primarily because I just opened myself up to those experiences, and having these collaborators and having these fellow writers and, you know, taking a deep dive on their work and sort of getting it really informed it to become an immigrant story and to be a more accurate cross-section of Boston at that time and America at this time. So, I mean, I'm more proud of that than anything else. I took that leap and I had the confidence with them at my back, and I'm just so thrilled. And it's been such a great artistic breakthrough, in a sense, to populate something that's truthful, but it's also truthful outside of my own experiences. And that challenge has just opened up so much for me.
And the thing that I was hit by, and I think everybody that was there when I saw it was hit by as well, is, and without giving anything away, but there's a rise that comes up out of this. There's a rise that, in a certain sense, you're not really expecting, but it really ties together everything that has happened and actually calls into question all of the things that have been, particularly on the level of male domination of society and what's happening there, and all of the various things that men go through to, you know, as they're marching down across the planet saying men, 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 and destroying the entire planet and each other. And then there's something that happens at the end, which I thought was brilliant the way that came out, because it just, it both stepped out and it slapped the audience in the head. And really, I mean, I think it just brought everything together in a point that gave the play an extra sharp edge that I thought was really important today.
Well, I'm so glad you say that. I mean, my instinct was to go full throttle and, like, hit some stuff over the head too much. And, you know, Joe was great in sort of pulling me back and saying, like, look, let's, we have it, it's enough. In that particular moment, I think I know what you're talking about towards the end. That's the wonderful thing about theater is collaboration with the actors and the director and the designers and everything. And you really feel it taking a life of its own, and you listen to it, and that sort of revealed itself. In particular, that last scene didn't reveal itself until we were about to go into previews, and it sort of got on its feet, and then you kind of saw what it was, saw what wasn't working, saw the potential it had, and to finally make that statement and sort of take the out of it in a way and subvert the whole thing. And, you know, we really, you look, I mean, the truth of it is, as much as we loved the piece and had so much fun to do it, we were terrified putting it out there for that first couple of shows because we just didn't know what we had. We didn't know if people would connect with it. And, you know, I've never written a piece that is so requires the audience to participate. And we really, it was one of the best feelings is to say, oh, wow, all our hard work is really connecting. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic. Yeah.
All right, John, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Unfortunately, we do have to move on, so because the show is about, they're going to drag me out of the studio right now. Okay.
So. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate your ongoing support of theater, and it means a lot to us. We are paying attention, so thank you so much
for doing that. Sure, John. Take care now.
Have a great night.
Bye-bye. You too. All right, you've just been listening to a conversation with John Polano, who is the author of the play Rules of Seconds. All right, and now I have something special I want to share with you. I'd like to share this with you. I know a lot of you are anguished about the times we're in. The war on Syria is just the latest example, and many of you are part of the resistance. You listen to and support The Michael Slate Show because you want to understand the world and impact it. We are now calling for volunteers to work on the show, to not only continue to bring the kind of programming that people need in these times, but to improve and expand the show and its reach. We need people for every facet of the show, and it doesn't matter where you live, where you're at, anything. If you want to work on the show, we need you. We need people to help with researching guests and content, with getting the show out on the internet, especially social media, sound editing of recorded shows for broadcast on stations outside of LA, transcribing selected interviews for print and web publication, outreach and publicity. And like I said, you can do this from anywhere. That is, anywhere with an internet connection. So write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Become part of our team. Become part of the resistance in this way. You can also send a direct message on Twitter or Facebook. Hope to hear from you soon. All right, and now we come to the part of the show that it's always hardest to do each and every week. This is the part it just tears me up to do. And because we have to sign out, we have to leave you for another week. And I want to thank everybody who's worked on the show today. I want to thank all of my guests today. That would be Sansara Taylor, Michael Mann, and John Polono. And I also want to thank the folks who've worked on this show. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op, Kiana Williams. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And sisters and brothers, just keep your mind on this during this week that's going to come before we talk again. These are some hellified times, and there's been a call for 10 days, 10 days that could shake the world, that should shake the world, all right? 10 days of mass resistance against what this fascist regime is bringing down on the people all over the world. So remember, it's your responsibility as a sentient, progressive human being to do what you need to do to stop fascism now. We're going to go out now with Amazing Disgrace, which is basically it's from the World Saxophone Quartet and their album Political Blues. Check this out, Amazing Disgrace.
Amazing Disgrace. When they brought us to this godforsaken place, they raped our mothers, incarcerated our fathers, stole all the land. But in spite of all that, everything will be okay. And that's a natural fact. But nobody will never, they will never be free until they free me and we. Oh, 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 oh. Brought us to